In April 1995, breakfast radio in the UK was about to be turned on its head.
Chris Evans is a working-class lad from Warrington.
He will need to be managed.
It would never be quite the same again.
The disc jockey Chris Evans.
Saviour of Radio 1.
Here we go.
The Chris Evans Breakfast Show was about to launch on BBC Radio 1, and I was part of it.
He just came on with this optimism and energy and zest. Don't worry, I'm here now, it's going to be fine.
All right then, that's what's just happened right here, right now, on this station.
That's the story.
I'm Holly Samos, also known as Holly Hot Lips, and along with Dan McGrath, or Dan the Sound Man, as he was known, and Johnny Boy Revel, we were the team that formed the backbone to the most revolutionary and at times controversial breakfast show to hit UK radio. For the first time in 25 years, the three of us have got together again behind a microphone to share the stories about what really went on behind the scenes, the shenanigans both on and off air, and the fun that we had that helped make the Chris Evans Breakfast Show the most listened to radio programme of the 90s.
Wonderful music, a talented jock, Monday to Friday from 6:30 to 9 o'clock.
This is Breaking Breakfast.
Matthew Bannister, obviously the then controller at Radio 1, said to me, there were two things about the show that he said rated really well with the listeners. One was the soap opera aspect of the show, us talking about our private lives. And the other thing was Chris talking to famous people. Because I think it was that notion that whenever Chris, or even probably the show, welcomed somebody famous onto it, we didn't do the kind of junket thing of saying, so tell me about your book. You know, we'd ask them about the cost of a pint of milk, or it would just descend into something else. Or we'd submit them to our shtick that we had already.
It was,
you know,
a bit more pub like.
It was. It was kind of like, you're here to enjoy what we do, wasn't it? I mean,
or to indulge us.
Or indulge us.
Whilst
and
we
endure,
talk bollocks for ages.
Endure what we do on a daily basis. Yeah. So it didn't really matter who they were, how famous they were. And of course, they came on the show. I mean, we got to really, really high profile people because, of course, the show was very high profile and it was the thing to be on.
The bad news is tomorrow's Monday, but the good news is from 6:30 a.m. there'll be more of this.
Hey,
O'Connor, he's here.
Hello, who's that ringing
Hello,
me?
Who's this?
It's just Ian, right? Just wanted to ask you about the tactics for tomorrow's game.
Well, watching your defence lately, I would brick up the goal.
Wake up to the best of everything on the Radio 1 Breakfast Show. It's good for you. 6:30 a.m. only on 97-99 FM, Radio 1.
One of the best ones, I think, was for me, was it would have been about 96, I think. And George Michael at the time was working on a new album, possibly had a new album out, but didn't do interviews with anybody, was not doing interviews really. It was still around the time where he hadn't come out, and I think he was still very guarded about who he spoke to and you know, all that kind of stuff. We got the nod from the promoter. George Michael's promoter at the time said, he'll do an interview, but he'll do it with Chris. He'll talk to Chris. So Chris says to me, we've got an interview with George Michael, we're going to go and interview him.
And we rarely did pre-recorded stuff,
did we? Rarely did, but it was George Michael.
Yes.
And, you know, and as far as most of us on that show is concerned, certainly me and Chris, it was like, we're going to do this.
Absolutely.
George,
for sure.
Michael. Yeah. So Chris and I meet in somewhere near Notting Hill in West London to go to Psalm West, which is the studio where Band Aid recorded.
Do they know it's
Live
Christmas?
Aid.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, famous studios run by Trevor Horn. So Chris and I meet in Notting Hill, and we're so, again, totally unprepared, really, with all these sort of things. We sit in a bar, and we get a piece of paper out and go, right, what are we going to ask George Michael? So we start coming up with questions for George Michael with about 20 minutes to go.
Yeah.
These days, you'll be spending hours, you have a whole team in, you know, what can you say to him, what can't you say to him, you know.
Yeah.
So we scrawl some questions on a piece of paper, and we go down to Psalm West, and the only request that George has had for this whole interview is that we get a case of Merceau, white burgundy wine in. That's what he drinks. That's what he wants. Don't know anything, but you must supply that because that's how he's going to get well old and have a good time and talk during this interview. So we arrive. Got the Merceau? Yep, Merceau arrives. His Labrador's running around. George Michael had a Labrador called Puppy or Billy or I don't know, lovely dog. He was as camp as Christmas. It was so funny. He was so lovely. And you're just thinking, anyway, you know, so we meet him and go into the studio. He and Chris sit down. I sit in the control room. They start drinking white wine. I'm allowed to stay in the control room. Everybody else has to go, because the whole point of this interview with him was that it was going to be really close and intimate and, you know, no holds barred kind of thing. And I think that maybe they thought, you know, Chris probably will ask difficult questions. I can't remember what we'd written. We probably go, what's your favourite cup of tea? You know.
Yeah.
Dan, who you've met, he's in the other room, and he shut up right, and his heart was pounding, and in the middle of his sleep, he thought, what are we going to ask George Michael? Bang, bang, bang. Right? Have you thought about this interview at all? What am I going to ask?
That everyone presumes that I don't do interviews because I've got loads of things I don't want to talk about, which is not the truth at all. And I've had to reassure people that I'm perfectly... I'm a big boy, you know. If people ask me something, I don't want to tell them the answer.
So I'm now sat in the control room at Psalm West. I've hung a couple of mics out over Chris and George. I'm sat there thinking, this is one of the most amazing things in my life ever, because I was and still am a huge George Michael fan. Mm. I'm watching George Michael there I've just met, talking to Chris, who I'm working with on the Radio 1 Breakfast Show. I press record and run the DAT tape, and I sit there with these two faders, and they start chatting. And I realise about a minute into it that the mics aren't in the right positions, and they're starting to say, oh, you know, so tell me about blah, blah. And I'm sat there thinking, this is not sounding right. And if I don't say anything, I'm in big trouble. So I have to go it like through the door. Gentlemen, you know, what, you know, they're trying to, what? Sorry, but I've just got to move this because it's not, I go in and I sort of shuffle this mic around in front of George. I'm thinking, oh man, he must think I'm a right idiot. And he looked at me and he went, well done. Good call. You know, he just gave me the nod to say, yeah, fair play to you.
You did the right thing.
Fair play to you. Anyway, so we record this interview. We finish. They're a bit pissed. We sit in the control room. George comes into the control room and says, right, look, I've been working on some things. Do you want to hear them? So me and Chris are now sat in Psalm West with George Michael, with his Oppo, and he's putting on demos of stuff he's been working on and asking our opinion on it. So I'm now sat there thinking, okay, so not only have I just done all this, brilliant, I'm now being asked by George Michael, who's putting on demo tapes of what he's been working on. It's a Bonnie Raitt cover of I Can't Make You Love Me. I think he was telling us some story, met somebody on a plane, da-da-da-da-da. I'm blown away at this point. Puts this thing on, and for 4 minutes, however long it lasts, it's a beautiful, sparkling rendition, and his vocals are George Michael, and the whole thing's luscious. Finished, and he looked at us and he went, what do you think? And I went, you'll go far. And he went, oh, shut up, fuck off. He swore like a trooper.
Did he?
Yeah, he swore like a trooper. He was brilliant. And I said to him, I've got to ask you one question. That vocal on there, is that all one take, two takes? What is it? And he said, no, we pretty much do it line by line. I said, I'm so glad you said that, because if you'd sung that in one take, I'd hate you.
That's amazing.
So we finish up there, we say thank you very much, we take all the tapes with us, and Chris and I ran off from Psalm West clicking our heels and spinning around going, we've just met you. It was just one of those euphoric moments where we ticked a massive box in our lives, you know, we've gone, we've done this, we've met him. And then I'd met him a couple of times after that, and he'd say hello and everything, and it was just like, yeah, George Michael.
What a star. Someone's gonna love.
So the Prince story, we had that all lined up, didn't we? That was, we were going to go to Paisley Park in Minneapolis. Prince was going to do a big concert at Paisley Park.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to the promoter, Neil Ferris, saying, listen, Prince will come onto your breakfast show if you come and do it from Paisley Park. Yep. So we were in.
So exciting.
We were in.
We were all beside ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember you telling me about it, John, and I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, I'm actually going to meet Prince.
We're going to Paisley Park. At his studio.
Yeah. And it happened really quickly, didn't it?
Do you remember all the gear arriving, all the cold weather gear? We got like Berghaus jackets and fleeces, all that arrived.
Because in the winter, you're up to your arse in snow.
The Beeb, they're like, right, everybody needs all the gear. So that all arrived.
And all the outside broadcast facility got on it and got everything into the plane ready for us to leave.
Yep. And I was driving somewhere in north of London and my phone goes. I think we've already said on the air we're going to Minneapolis. We might have mentioned it. I'm driving, my phone goes, and it's Neil Ferris who says to me, you know, you're all looking forward to coming. I said, oh, Neil, this is going to be great. We're really looking forward to it. You know, what, and is he going to stay for the whole show? What's he going to do?
We were going to do the show from Paisley Park.
And Prince was going to be on it. Mm. He said, oh, yeah, there's a little bit of a thing there, Dan. Obviously, it's like a big press junket. I was like, what do you mean? There's loads of other people going to this as well. I went, that's not what you sold it to me. You said to me it was like we were going to come and do the show. He'd come on the show. You know, it's going to be us with him and promote the album. And, you know, that's what you'll get from us. It's going to be brilliant. Chris will really go for it, you know. Well, no, I can't actually guarantee you'll either come on the show either. You know what it's like with these sort of people when you work with this talent. I went, I do, but that's not going to work. If you can't guarantee that he's coming on the show, so there's people on the tarmac now with flight cases just about to load the planes up. He's got to come on the show. And I said, not to mention, if I have to go back and tell Evans that he might not be on the show, there's a chink of light that he's not coming on, he'll pull it. He'll absolutely pull it.
Him and Prince have a conversation on the phone?
No, what they said was, you can interview him, but it will be through a sheet. Do you remember that? And they said, so you can't look at him or speak to him directly.
That's right.
Oh,
there will
Prince.
Be a sheet of Muslim.
That's right. And you were told, that's right, we got a directive through saying you mustn't look at him if he passes you in the corridors.
Yeah, so
I love him so much.
So Chris
Prince.
Can interview him. Like
I loved him so much.
Say that again. Yeah, there'll be a sheet of Muslim and he'll be behind it. Well, it might not be him. How do we know? It could be somebody else, you know. And then he won't, he'll answer questions. And of course, then that's when we did pull it.
He went on the air and went, we're not going.
No!
Not that long ago, John Ronson, the author, tweeted out that he got the seat on the plane that went out to Minneapolis that Chris was meant to take on that aeroplane. So obviously the word went round the industry that everyone was going out. By that point, we'd bailed.
We'd already pulled. But then that leads on to your new best friend, George Michaels.
Absolutely.
Because I remember you going out for dinner with him, you and Chris again, because you're now best buddies with him.
Mm.
And I think you went for Chinese, because I do remember, I wasn't there, but I distinctly remember you going for dinner with George and recounting this story.
About Prince.
And then he told you his.
Yeah, then George said to us, and there is a lot of swearing in this story, because George did swear a lot when he told it. He said, I was in New York and I'm in a nightclub. This is George Michael talking. I'm in a nightclub and this big bouncer comes up to me and says to me, Prince wants to meet you. So George said, so I said, oh, yeah, that's, I'm well up for meeting Prince. That'd be great. So he said, so I'm ushered into this back room somewhere where I have to sit down. He said, and I sit in this back room, right, for like 50 fucking minutes, right? I sit there, it goes on forever, and I'm waiting. But it is, you know, it's Prince, so I'm waiting. He said, anyway, eventually he comes in, and he's got his entourage with him, and he's got this scarf over his face, so I can't see his fucking face, right? So I sit there and I talk at him for like 25 minutes, right? It must be 25 minutes. I talk at him. He doesn't say a fucking word, right? He doesn't say a fucking word. He said, it goes on and on and on, and I keep on talking, and then he just leaves. He said, I'm not being fucking funny, right? But I am George Michael. And we were like, yeah, you are, George. And I'm with you on that, mate. It's true, you know. And no, that's right. And then he said, I was in a nightclub late, like a few months later. Same fucking bouncer comes up to me and says, Prince wants to meet. He said, I fucking ran a mile. Meeting that guy.
Oh, I love him.
So one of the great characters of the show.
Steady.
In the early days. He didn't last very long.
Matthew Bannister actually came to me and said to me, you've got to stop doing this character, Dan.
So, and this character is Charlie Chuckles.
Charlie Chuckles came out of me doing JLR with Chris.
Yeah, yeah.
And I again, probably something in the pub, I started doing impressions of Derek Giler, who was, was he an actor and a musician?
Yeah, he was an old comedy actor.
Yeah, he had a washboard.
Yeah, yeah.
And all we did on the JLR show is Chris would say something and Derek would answer it and Chris would say something a bit mean back and Derek would literally just say, well, it's not really to be like that, Chris. That was it, because Derek Giler, as his character on telly, would say that to people. It's not really to be like that. And that just turned into Charlie Chuckles, who then became this big fat northern comedian. That was the idea. So all the jokes were based around being overweight. So Charlie Chuckles literally just went on the air and said terrible things that weren't funny about the fact that he was obese, and Chris would feed me the lines. And it was horrible. I used to shake as I gave him the script.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he'd go, have you done the script? And I'd be like, I'd give it to him and I could see him looking at the script, right, while the record was playing. Yeah. And I could, you know, you could read him like a book. You could see him looking, thinking, oh, these are terrible. Or he'd look at them and he'd put them down and you think, oh, no, he likes those. Yeah. We're in. This will be good. And Charlie Chuckles was just terrible. Well, I'll tell you what, Chris, I was out this morning and they all said, boy, yeah, it was all that. It was terrible. Yeah, it was.
Right here on Radio 1. And, oh, you're going to hear a lot of him. You're going to hear a lot of this guy. Charlie Chuckles is here. Oh, hello, dear. Charlie. How you doing? The children's favourite.
Oh, fine.
Charlie, did I see you at the BAFTAs last night?
Oh, you did, Christopher. Shut up, please.
OK.
Oh, you what? Did, mate. I'll tell you what. Oh. Anyway, this taxi arrived to take me and the wife to the aforementioned event, mate.
Yeah.
And to get into it, you see, you had to go through a pair of wooden swing doors.
Wooden swing doors? What, in the taxi?
That's right, mate. You see, it was a saloon car.
Oh, Charlie.
Oh, dear, so I'll tell you what, mate.
Eventually got a phone call or an email from somebody who said, I am Charlie Chuckles. And I was like, oh, right, OK. And I'm a children's entertainer. You must stop doing what you're doing on the Radio 1 Breakfast Show because I'm not getting any work. The parents who booked me think I'm you and they really don't want me in their front room with their small children. So sorry. So I went to Emma and went, we better change it because it's not fair on the poor guy. We're decimating his career. And that's how shit it was. And so we changed it to Charlie Manning.
Charlie Manning. Yeah. Who was even less funny.
Funny. It got less funny the more the name got less funny as well. Yeah.
It didn't last long, did it? It's like on the bog. It didn't last that long, those features.
It didn't last long. It lasted, I remember how long it lasted. It went through the summer of 96. So the day Matthew Bannister phoned me up and said, you've got to stop doing that character, I was probably relieved. I was probably like, you know, let's move on from this. But the problem with it was that it survived. We kept it going. And we inflicted him on famous people, didn't we?
Well, it was a Christmas Christmas special. We were pre-recording some inserts for it. So we teed up a couple of pre-records. One was with Cher. So Cher came in. And the other one was with Mick Hucknall.
Show me.
So Hucknall comes in. So Dan and I had the most brilliant idea that Dan would interview Mick Hucknall as Charlie Manning, because we thought that'd be brilliant. That'd be really funny.
And we thought there'd be some connection because Mick was from Manchester.
From Charlie was a northern, southern exactly.
Wimbledon boy.
We thought this is a match made in heaven. This is genius. So Hucknall, and you know, if you don't know Mick Hucknall, he can be a bit surly and a bit miserable, can't he?
Right.
And so I'm standing in the studio talking to him. I said, so Mick, this is Dan. And Dan's like, hello. So, and I said, so at some point during this interview, Dan will switch from being Dan into one of his characters, who's a very funny northern comedian. And as I was saying, very funny northern comedian, I'm thinking, fucking hell, why am I saying this? And then Hucknall was looking at me with daggers, a bit like when Simon Cowell looked at us, looking at us. I said, very funny. He's called Charlie Manning.
He's going to interview you.
So, Dan, give him a bit. Just do a bit of Charlie Manning for Mick so he knows that when you've switched characters, just give him a bit. So, Dan then goes. Hucknall's looking at us, thinking, get me out of here. So we start, tapes rolling and we're off. So then Dan just, now Mick.
But we didn't do a whole show. So these were cold.
Just inserts. Yeah,
these were cold. So we were coming into these things and actually sat silent.
Right.
And launching into, during a show, you're vibing and you're up to speed.
Yeah.
And I remember simply making some comment about that little diamond he's got in his tooth. You know, he's got that diamond in his tooth.
Yeah.
And he smiled, obviously, wryly or out of anger. Out of pain, and I made some terrible comment about this thing in his tooth, and that was it. The shutters came down. Mick Hucknall was not joining in with this interview or whatever. It wasn't even an interview. It was just. No.
And then he
awful.
Went, and then Cher came in. So Cher,
amazing,
a global superstar. Cher came in.
Interviews,
and so. And then we came up, Dan, so like, because Chris was saying, came up with some ideas. So we shares. And I think I've got a copy of the FT and looking at Cher. I mean, it was just desperate. Desperate. You know, we were desperate.
That's radio gold these days, something like that.
We were like, so I said, right, Cher, this is the Financial Times.
Read
it's
the
like, you know,
index.
So we're going to get the shares. And so off you go. She's all made up.
Yeah.
You know, she's got full makeup on in the afternoon.
She looked at me with that very surprised look on her face, and I thought that was Charlie Manning, but it was just that she constantly has a surprised look on her face. Right. I thought yeah, she's
because everything's so tight.
This
was pre-Botox, so everything was pulled up tight behind her. I do remember her kissing me on the lips, though.
Oh, really?
It was quite funny. Yeah.
Lovely.
There was no payoff with Charlie.
Not off the back of Cher Cher. She wasn't so pleased about that feature.
Next time on Breaking Breakfast.
The beauty of the roadshow is it doesn't start till 11 o'clock.
And this guy is asleep on my shoulder. And then someone opened the door and said, "Oi, Jim, you're on."
And I went up and shook his hand, but it was a false hand.
And it was just a disaster.
And he's standing there, bollock naked.
I know.
Come on in.
Go away!
I'm Holly Samos, and this is Breaking Breakfast. Use the hashtag Breaking Breakfast, all one word, to talk about it on social. Leave us a review or rating and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. It's recorded at Canon Studios, and the series producer is Nick Goodman. Breaking Breakfast is a Bounce production.